Good evening, everyone, and welcome to WILL's Community Cinema Screening and Discussion. I'm Henry Radcliffe, Community Engagement Producer and Community Cinema Series Manager at Illinois Public Media, WILL, radio, TV, and online. All across the country, people and communities, 100 of them in fact, are coming together to watch and discuss tonight's film, Pushing the Elephant. Public television is known for our high-quality, independent documentaries, and tonight we hope to live up to our reputation for bringing cinema out to the community to watch and enjoy, but also engage in meaningful discussion about local connections to the issues in the film. In order that we do that, we have with us tonight Professor Bokamba, professor from the Department of Linguistics and from the Department of African Studies at the University of Illinois. And of course, we are grateful to our national partner, the Independent Television Service, who brings the community cinema series to all of us public television stations and provides us with quality independent documentaries to air every week on WILL-TV and the public broadcasting system, and our partner, the Champaign Public Library. We will show tonight's film with closed captioning, and our discussion will be signed for the deaf by Peter Kroom. The Office of Disabilities, Resources, and Educational Services has connected us to Peter. The discussion will be recorded by Mike Pritchard and moderated by Jack Brighton. There are some surveys that I'd like for you to fill out if you would like at the end, and a sign-in. And we will begin the film in just a second. We'd like to begin our discussion, and I thank you all for staying, and I hope you will take a part in the discussion.
Quite a film. Can everybody hear me okay? Great. My name is Jack Brighton. I'm with WILL, Illinois Public Media, and I'm joined here by Dr. Iyamba Bokamba, and we wanted to have a general conversation about the film, your thoughts, questions, et cetera. That's what this is all about, and Dr. Bokamba will give some his thoughts, and we'll just kind of go from there. And I may have some questions, but I defer to you if you'd like to do that. Let me just tell you a little bit more about Dr. Bokamba. He's a native of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's currently professor of linguistics and African languages, professor of African American studies, and director of the languages program in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Illinois. He's also been serving as an African linguist and director of the program in African languages since 1974, and also previously served as associate director and acting director of the Center for African Studies at the university, in addition to a number of other administrative positions. He's also been an activist scholar since he has been in school and out all throughout his career. He's been a longtime advocate for the liberation and democratization of Africa. And he's organized conferences and spoke broadly. He's also executive director of the Center for Research on the Congo, established in Washington, D.C. in 1979, and also speaks quite often on this topic. So we're very glad to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brighton. Thank you. Yes, as Mr. Brighton said, this is quite a film. It is moving in many ways and very complex, much more complex than what appears to be on the film itself. So I thought maybe I'll do two things to sort of contextualize our discussion this evening. The first thing is that what you have seen is perhaps the exception, the survival of a large family, with children, mother, but losing a father, as opposed to many others that are not able to tell the story that Mapendo is able to tell and have her family with her, even though, again, she lost her husband and had to leave home. But the story behind the story that you have seen is much more complex than it appears. From the documentary, it seems as if this was some kind of a ethnic conflict involving soldiers on one hand and tipping themselves against one ethnic group, namely the the Tutsi ethnic group in the Congo. If history as constructed by Belgians who had ruled both, in fact, more than both, the Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi, is accurate, and it's not quite accurate, but it is estimated that there are 250 languages spoken in the Congo, was estimated then, but more recent studies show that there are about 214. So if you take each of those 214 languages and equate them to an ethnic group, you have that many ethnic groups in the Congo. The Tutsis in the Congo, or the Banyamulenge in eastern Congo, only one of those 214. But what occurred in 1996 that led to Mapendo and many other people losing their lives was not a civil war. There was never a civil war, contrary to what is told in the newspapers and written elsewhere. What occurred was an invasion of the Congo as a regime change to remove President Joseph Désiré Mobutu, who was established in that position by none other than the CIA, and for 32 years he ruled supreme, with the West eating off of his palm, forgiving his debts towards the World Bank, and while he was suppressing his own people in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, being curtailed. Basically, this was another dictator, no different from Mubarak, no different from the Shah of Iran, you name him, okay, of the West and East. But what occurred in 1996 represents a case in which Rwanda and Uganda were used by the powers to be that were fighting over mineral resources, more specifically unfettered access to mineral resources in the Congo. And those were two major agencies belonging to two governments, the CIA on our side and the French equivalent of the CIA. Mobutu was thought to have been, to have become much more sort of interested more in dealing with the French than with the United States. And some businessmen found their way to interest the government so that they can undertake covert action. What I am telling you, so that you don't think that this story is coming from me, is from books. And I've given you a handout, a testimony from Mr. Wayne Madison. If you don't have it, there are copies in the back. We made about 50 copies of those. This is part of his testimony out of a book that he published in 1999 called Genocide and Covert Action in Africa, 1993-1999. Okay? He's not the only one who wrote about this. Another investigative journalist from Belgium who did not know of Madsen's work published something similar and did name names. Example in point includes the CEO of American Minerals, okay, in the mineral fields, who at the time was working and I had the headquarters of the company in no other place than Hope, Arkansas. Reportedly, he was a close friend of the Clintons and supported his campaign and so on. He's also the very first person who gave Laurent Kabila, the father of the current president, his first airplane and signed a contract with him. So Rwanda was used as a client state. with Uganda in tow, and they picked a man by the name of Laurent Kabila to be the facade so that they can say this is a rebellion, involves the Banyamulenge. The sad thing is that the Banyamulenge don't know this story, nor do the other Congolese ethnic groups, that this is the background to what appeared to have been a civil war and a rebellion of a sort. So from there on, what transpired became even more evident as Rwanda and Uganda fought in Kisangani in eastern Congo over diamonds in Kisangani. It took several years from 1996 to 2003 to end the rebellion which they created and the multiple militias that they created. If you have time to Google Global Witness Report 2004, you will see the chart of the elite looters of the Congo came from no other place than those who were created to be rebels. Currently, one of those rebel leaders by the name of Bemba is facing the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He's been in jail for at least a year and a half now. But he's only one of them. The other one is sitting in the Congo as president because he is the one who's named in this documentary, Joseph Kabila. He was officially, from the father's perspective, the chief of the army who led part of the invasion from Rwanda into the dismantling of the refugee camps where those who committed genocide in Rwanda were living and, creating warfare between Congo and Rwanda, or at least going back and forth. But unofficially and visibly, the person who was in charge of the army, because this gentleman didn't have much of military training, it was Kabarebe. Who's Kabarebe? Kabarebe was the chief of the armed forces in Rwanda. Today, he is the Minister of Defense. When he went back from Congo, he's maintained his position as chief of the army. He's the one who led the army. So it was not a Congolese-created thing. And we know this from various documents, including colleagues who were invited to join the rebellion, and they wanted to know who was, in charge. When they learned that somebody is calling them from Rwanda, they said, well, why isn't the Congolese, whom you claim to be in leadership, calling me to ask me? And so on. So what I'm trying to point out is that the story is much, much more complex. As we speak today, Mrs. Mapendo and her family are in Phoenix, but every day, every month, there are at least 1,250 people who are dying in eastern Congo, totaling about 31,000 people each month because of the demilitarized mining access to Congolese resources. Congo has no competition when it comes to mineral resources. Other resources are plentiful. Among these resources that are this, the basic source of the conflict is coltan, or colombium tantalum, which is a material that is used for your telephones, namely digital equipment, cell phone, anything that has circuitry contains coltan. How is that related to the Congo? It is reported that 80% of the known resources of that mineral is found in eastern Congo. And this is in addition to other mineral resources such as diamond, cobalt, you name it. The Congo has it. So Rwanda, Uganda, Burundi and a number of other countries, and those outside, particularly those who support, you know, them in that effort, are looting the Congo, and Mrs. Mapendo and the like of her are the ones who are suffering. But why the women? Are they being targeted most? This is to sort of, how should I say, create a sense of dysfunctionality of the community, to, you know, raise the level of terrorism so that when husbands and sons and so on see their own mother, sister, and so on being violently raped and the reproductive system destroyed and Dr. Mukwege has to repair them, it creates a level of fears that these husbands and so on will no longer take their wives or even look after them, etc., and create, therefore, the kind of situation that prevails, which, in part, Mrs. Mapendo, who was fortunate, was, you know, referring to, but she said she couldn't talk about those things. They were private things, remember her statement? This is the story of how, as it were, the West and now the East is accessing African resources, reminding us of the early periods of King Leopold II, who drove the Congo or ran the Congo as if it was his private fiefdom and in the process committed Holocaust. 10 million people out of 20 million died during the period of King Leopold II. So, who knows? The story may repeat itself, but you hear of the genocide in Rwanda, which was horrific and horrible and shouldn't have happened and shouldn't happen again, because this was the second time it's happened. They lost 800,000 people, close to a million. The Congo has lost over 6 million people. You don't see it on the first page of the New York Times and so on. And the women who were suffering there, you don't see that story on the first page either, and so on and on. But yet, we are the ones who benefit, whether we are in the East or West, who are benefiting the looted resources from the Congo. And the victims are average people like you and I and Mrs. Mapendo and family. And she's most courageous to be able to go back and try to hopefully, see, thanks, bring peace. She'll never succeed. You heard it from me, because she's not the one who's running the show. Other people, companies, governments are interested in what is obtainable from the Congo in an unfettered fashion, and that's what we have here. The question then becomes, how do we react as citizens, right? How can we be of some help in these kinds of situations so that Mrs. Mapendo and the like of her are not the only ones? And particularly, given that those who remain in the Congo and Rwanda or Burundi and so on have no voice, they can speak, but they cannot get a hearing because the individuals who are in charge there are not listening to them. They have other people who are, you know, pulling the strings to direct them. So let me stop here because I can go on and on. I have pages and pages of documentation on this situation, but we want to give you that background so that you can see this in a proper perspective rather than seeing it as a matter of ethnic conflict. It was never the case.
Thank you, Dr. Bakamba. We do have a microphone, and we would invite you to use it because we're recording this. If you have questions or thoughts or reactions, please don't be shy because this is about a conversation. We just saw a film, but a film shouldn't just be seen. It should be discussed, and that's so right. That's what we're here to do.
Absolutely.
If someone has some... There we go.
I think it's on.
Yeah. There we go.
Okay. I was just wondering, is it... I know her journey to America and her position now wasn't easy, but she is in a very more comfortable position than a lot of people. So I'm wondering, is it possible for others to come and be as successful as she has been? Because I know it's a very tough struggle. I know I'm not really sure what the process is, but just wondering, is it possible for others to become as stable as she is now?
It is immigration from the Congo, from many African countries, is not as easy. One has to have certain connections and be perhaps rescued at the right time and have the means to be sent overseas where you can be received by a church and so on. I happen to have traveled to both Congo and Congo-Brazzaville, which is the other country on the side of the Congo River, with a group of missionaries to visit projects that they sponsored there. And in that visit, one of the stories that we heard was about refugees from Congo who ran into Brazzaville, and their case is still pending. There must have been about 13 men and women who have presented their story to the UNHCR, but they are waiting for an opportunity to be given a chance to get out of there because they are still being threatened by the current regime in Congo-Kinshasa, namely Kabila, who is hunting, supposedly his regime, looking for them. Coming out of eastern Congo, it's even much more difficult because, again, it depends on where you are. And the UN, in spite of a large force of some 17,000, have been sort of, quote-unquote, trying to keep the peace, but there's no peace to keep because the militarization of mines that are not being operated by companies but rather by militia, controlled by different, you know, politicians and so on, and by members of the Congolese, note, Congolese Armed Forces, which is not an army. It's a group of militia that they put together in order to try to stop the war that was, you know, pervasive in the country for the period of, you know, 6 years. Making it difficult for people to have a life that will allow them, in some cases, to escape. So economically, connections and so on account for who can get out and who cannot. Many of them unable to. Most of them, they can't. You saw the two women with their holes in the farm. Those are the women who are targeted among those who are targeted because they're easy prey. Nobody's there and they're targeted. And others right at in their home in front of their children and so on. Something that one who is a parent cannot accept, but that's what is happening.
Do you have a representative other than the lady that was in the picture? Does the president know about this thing? Is he aware of what's happening in the Congo and all the refugees that are coming here?
Which president is
it? I mean, President Obama.
President Obama is aware of it, as well as the Secretary of State. In fact, the Secretary Clinton was in the Congo in 2009, wasn't it? Yeah, she went to Congo 2009 and didn't stop just in the capital city in Kinshasa, but went all the way to the east and did meet some of the women. There is, in fact, a law that was passed by Congress. I think it's H.R. 2035, something I can't remember, involving the sort of licensing of minerals so that people will know where they are coming from, so monitoring this. But it is not as easy. As we have been here, there would have been over 10, 15, airplanes that would have landed in eastern Congo to pick up this artisanal minerals, cross Rwanda and carry them from Rwanda or Uganda to ship them to Switzerland, to United States, to Japan, you name it. Those small fields are created and nobody is in control, as it were.
So all these 214 languages that you have, these are 214 people.
Supposedly. I mean, this is the nature of, in United States, we are sort of fortunate to think that we are pervasively monolingual. But imagine all the other ethnic groups that I migrated here. United States is not monolingual, it's multilingual. But in African countries, because of the nature of colonization, speakers of various languages were simply divided up for the purposes of access to territory and therefore resources for European countries. So you have different linguistic groups belonging to one country. But I can assure you, if you look at the history of the Congo, you won't find a single time, except when Mobutu fomented this intentionally, ethnic rivalry of the sort that will lead to genocide or the kind of fights that have taken place in eastern Congo. People live peacefully among one another, and many of those speak each other's language. So it's not an issue.
So it's genocide by this one man against the rest of the people, the refugees in the Congo. Is that basically what it is?
Well, the genocide started in Rwanda. In that case, it was the so-called Tutsi versus Hutu. But in reality, the Tutsi and the Hutu are one and the same people.
So they're not fighting against each other?
Right? No, they were pit to fight against each other for purposes of the equivalent of, seeking access to power. So one group takes over and wants to exclude the other and so on. So that they've been, the genocide that occurred in 1994 was not the first one in Rwanda. It has occurred before. Kagame grew up in Uganda because of a previous genocide. And his coming back to Rwanda represented a way of trying to reconquer power. And reportedly, the Hutu constitute about 85% of the population, the Tutsi 15%. These are the same people. They understand one another.
And forgive me, this is the question I think that, I'm really interested in what you think about this. It seems that when the press, the media attempts to tell the story, it becomes a story about the Hutu versus the Tutsi. Ethnic, perhaps even tribal kind of conflict.
Absolutely.
But if you look under the surface of this, it would seem that that's simply, sort of a proxy for the real power struggle, which is really sort of a convenient excuse to say this is why the war is occurring.
Mm. Yeah. No, it is simplistic. It is simplistic. The part of the reality is that the Belgians created those two so-called ethnic groups by promoting the Tutsi as the ones that were more associated with the royal, house.
Right.
And the intellectuals and so on, whereas the Hutu were seen as the farmers, the laborers. And so the perpetuation of that over a period of several decades during colonization. See, Rwanda was not officially colonized by Belgium. It was a protectorate. But just like in the case of South Africa, with what has now become Namibia, they treated it as a colony. Many of the intellectuals from Rwanda and Burundi studied in the Congo. So those three countries were seen as, essentially one colony of Belgium with three different, manifestations of territories. So that became part of the accepted, rhetoric and culture, so that you can separate the Hutus from the Tutsis. So to a point where the conflict about access to power has become increasingly an issue, and that's how it started. You may recall, those of you who read some of this, that story, what launched or at least to the extent that it became evident to the rest of the world, the genocide was the assassination of two presidents, the former president of Rwanda and the former president of Burundi, who were coming from a meeting in Tanzania where they were supposed to have the Peace Accord. Okay. Today, there are denials as to who shut down the plane, but you can read from Madison. He tells you what his hypothesis is. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the conflict, between the Hutus and the Tutsis, was that in 94? What ended that conflict?
It was President Kagame's decision that he had enough. Well, first of all, his group was successful in subduing the Hutu genociders. And secondly, when they ran into Congo, in eastern Congo, if we had the map, you would see that it's just a matter of crossing a few miles and you are in eastern Congo, because those two countries are adjacent to one another, and stayed there with UN refugee camps, but they took their guns with them. So they continued to go back and forth, waging guerrilla warfare. And after calling upon the United Nations to stop this, and they were not paying attention, or at least were not acting fast enough, he decided that it was time he was going to dismantle that. And he was right. He came to dismantle it by invading the camp and routing everybody. In the process, many people died, but people don't, you know, talk about that. And that was used as an excuse to keep chasing those who committed genocide to the extent of crossing an entire continent, because the Congo is almost a continent by itself, to the west, chasing those who committed genocide. But as Kabila was brought to power, it became evident that it was not just a matter of chasing the genocide, was access to, you know, resources, and that it was not Kagame's own doing, as Madison points out, but that he was being used as a client state for purposes of removing Mobutu, whom they had installed in the first place in 1965.
Yeah. Okay, the movie, I don't know how much is true, the movie Hotel Rwanda.
Yes.
Okay, could the French, Belgium, you know, could
the
they
French.
Have stopped?
The French.
Yeah. Could they have stopped the genocide?
Could they have stopped the genocide?
Mm-hmm.
They could have stopped the genocide just as the United States could have stopped the genocide, but Clinton was not willing to do so. According to the late Senator Simon, a group of senators went to the president and they said, "Mr. President, we got to do something. There are UN, you know, forces there in Rwanda. Why don't we sort of give them additional support so that they can stop this genocide before it occurs?" Because there's nothing that transpired without our CIA knowing. They knew all that there was taking place. The president, according to Mr. Simon, told them that there was not support in Congress for engaging in war. And part of that is the effect of the Somali,
yes,
right? Invasion. It's not surprising. But they could have. The UN could have. The US could have helped to stop that. But it was not in their interest. If you follow the story I told.
No resources.
No.
Well, that's what I heard, because Rwanda didn't have any resources,
yes,
so they weren't interested.
No, that's true. But Rwanda is not a country that at that time could have successfully, you know, gone on to invade the Congo on their own. They were given, according to the stories by these investigative journalists, given support. I should mention for your information that Wayne Madsen is not just an investigative journalist. He was in the Army, in the Navy. This is an intelligence officer. So he knows what he's talking about in part. And the fact that others are talking about the same thing without knowing of his work, you know, stands to reason to say something was going on here that these two countries know, France and the United States. Okay.
I know, as one of the Jehovah's Witnesses, we have many witnesses living in those countries, and we wrote letters to the leaders there. I really don't know how much help it provided, but we did write letters.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you think that would help?
To the countries you mean, to Rwanda and to Congo?
Yeah. Well, not the Congo.
But to Rwanda.
To Rwanda.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So would writing the leaders there, do you think that would help?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I don't know. I think what would help is to write to our own senators, make Congress persons, not to say congressmen, even though that's neutral, right?
Congresspersons, right?
To enforce the laws that they have adopted. One of them has to do with the security of the Great Lakes, you know, region, of which the Congo is the largest in that Great Lake region, and the kind of suffering that is taking place there. I think that in Rwanda, President Kagame is doing an excellent job given the difficult circumstances under which he has had to lead that country. Many people criticize that it is a police state. Yes, it is a police state, but one that works. Look at the Congo. Nothing works. It's a failed state without any doubt. And there are other Congolese here. They can testify. I shouldn't be the only one speaking, but that's the reality of it. When you see the degree to which that country has economically collapsed, politically, and so on, we have ministers of education, ministers of public transportation, whose budget we don't know where it goes. So it's that day. And the United States knows. It knows very well. Several of us have spoken with the ambassador. We've gone to the State Department trying to make the case and so on. But here we have this young man who was only 30 when he took power after the assassination of his father, which assassination we don't even know who it is that committed the crime, and yet he's the president. There is no court case pending on finding out who killed Kabila. But he knows. The so-called son knows.
We're going to run out of time here in a minute. I want to just ask one thing. We hear very little about what's going on in Africa in general.
Right.
Unless it happens to be Libya right now.
Yes.
We see, and this is no criticism of anybody here, that this room has a lot of empty chairs. And Americans are probably not generally informed, apparently informed enough to be interested or interested enough to be informed. We probably don't know the history of the colonialism in a period in Africa. We probably don't know what's happened post-colonial period in Africa. Right. We don't know that the CIA was involved in assassinations of leaders, even in Iran. And this is a problem, it would seem, in addressing these things. And, you know, it's great to have a film like this that tells this story, but we need more stories. And I just wonder, you know, how we can, as people of this country, you know, sort of participate in encouraging that we come to some greater understanding of these things. You know, and certainly, you know, you're helping us a great deal by providing this background. But I guess my sole point is we need to do more.
Absolutely. Now, Jack, there's no question. We need to do more, and that's where the community comes in. And there are some people here from the, you know, Congolese and the rest of the African countries. We don't have as many representatives, but at least there are a few here who can,
My name is Guy. I'm a minister here in Champaign-Urbana. Just to answer your question is maybe if we start here in
where
Champaign
we are.
County, where we are.
That's right.
Because if we want to reach other states, it may be different. But do you know that there are 200 Congolese families here right now in Champaign-Urbana.
Men and women.
Men and women. And no, there are maybe 250 children from those families. Now, they are from Congo. They suffered the same trauma. But maybe they were not in the Tutsi or Banyamulenge tribe. They are from other tribes. And if we want to start somewhere, maybe we can start with those people, because they had another side of the story. They suffered the same, but because maybe the local media doesn't give this opportunity, as Sister Mapendo, thank God for her, because at least some people know now a lot
about
this. But if there is a place to start, we can start here in Champaign. And, there are not only Congolese. No, we have people suffer from a difficult time in Kenya, for example. And, we have brothers from Ivory Coast. It's going on right now, but it's not on TV because no one could put a camera on the big street in Ivory Coast. No, but every single day, people are dying. No?
Yes.
A couple of days ago, 15 women were killed in the street because there was just marching to say, no, you need to stop this war. And the government killed them.
Yeah.
So maybe we can start here. That would be a good point to start. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's also a good point to stop, because we're out of time, and that point was, I can't top that. Thank you very much.
And thank you, and Henry, for organizing this. We wish there were more people to fill these chairs, but we'll see what we can do at the next one, especially Bhutto, who was gunned down.
Dr. Bakamba, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.